how to appreciate God. Okay? The best thing is to start with an example. Okay? Now, I had a teacher that taught me the ideas of Torah. Okay? And at a certain point, I recognized the value of Torah. Now, therefore, the rabbi that taught me, or the teacher that taught me, he got it from all the way back to where God, to Torah Misinai, you know, from that God gave the Torah Mount Sinai. So therefore, I must recognize that because God created this system and people maintain the system, so therefore I have the benefit of that system. Okay? So therefore, appreciation of God comes through a certain process of recognizing where things come from. Okay? I'll give you another example. For instance, our sages wrote commentaries. So therefore, they helped us to understand the Torah. The reason why they wrote the commentaries is because they recognized from Torah that they have a sense of justice, that they must perpetuate the system, so they chose to write commentaries based on the needs of the people. Because they wrote for the needs of the people, so I get the benefit of that, and that again goes back to God, the way God set up the system. There might be people that write commentaries for their because of their own desires, but the greats do it. The reason why they do it, the best example of it, if you look at the Chovos Havavos, Duties of the Heart, in his introduction, he writes there, he says, he sees that the people are lacking in this area, and therefore he feels the responsibility to do it. But otherwise, he wouldn't have done it if he didn't feel this responsibility. Usually, philosophers do not have such a system, and they usually write because they want to express their philosophy, like you're saying, they have a desire to express their philosophy. In Judaism, the greats and the early writers and the leaders, they wrote because they had a sense of justice, and therefore, and they got that sense of justice through the study of Torah, and they're obligated to maintain the system and to perpetuate the system. So we see that appreciation of God is a process where you look back to the source of all the steps going back. When you appreciate, when you feel a certain appreciation, so then you go back and see where the source is of God. Another example. The Moshe Chaim Luzzatto wrote a book on logic. And in his introduction, he says that God created the world incomplete, and he gave it over to mankind to complete it. Now, in modern times, we have a new approach to psychology or psychiatry that has cured people. So therefore, it is because of God's world. It's true, man was the messenger to complete God's world and to discover new things. So therefore, because of that, again, even when somebody cures you, you have to understand that he has to, that it's already there. He's only discovering and bringing out God's world. Same thing with medicine. I mean, if you were sick 100 years ago with many of the diseases of today, I mean, it was over. You would die. Today, they have surgery and medicine that maintain life for a very long time. And the appreciation, you have to appreciate that the doctors, people in research brought it out. But however, it goes back to God that he set off a process of developing the physical world so that we could complete it and we could get the benefits of the physical world. However, these people, when they are messengers of God, the psychiatrists and the doctors, the people in research are messengers of God, they don't recognize that they are a messenger of God. But the truth is that is God's will, that they should do it. But their purpose is whatever motive that motivates them, but it's their own purposes. It's not a matter of justice. In other words, the human being is incomplete, like in justice, in wisdom, and the people that wrote about that in Torah, they recognized that they were just doing the will of God. But however, people like in science and psychology, they are completing the physical world, and that is God's will that the human should do it, but they don't recognize that they're doing God's will. They don't look at themselves as a messenger of God. Many of them don't accept God. You understand? But the fact is that the way God created the world, so therefore, and since God gave it over for the human being to complete the world, so therefore they are fulfilling that mission, that will of God, that's God's will, but they don't realize and they haven't accepted upon themselves to do it. So when you accept upon yourself to do it because it's the will of God, that's perfecting your soul and getting close to God. When you do it because of your own self reasons, so you are doing the will of God, but you don't realize it. You're a messenger of God without realizing it. But insofar as when you enjoy something in the physical world, appreciation of God is recognizing the process all the way back from you're getting the results all the way back to where it comes from, God. So therefore you recognize how it comes from God. You have to be careful. A very big mistake that people make in general is they have certain true ideas in their mind that they know, but in the particulars they don't carry it out. They don't recognize that they're really living in contradiction. In other words, like this, there's a lot of people say, yes, I appreciate what God does for me, but they don't see the details and they don't recognize. They say, yeah, God did this and God did that, like a mystical thing. They don't realize the details. They don't see it. So I'm saying, to really appreciate God, not only must you know the idea that you should appreciate God, but you should check out the process when you have certain results, to see how it fits in with God's system all the way back to either Mount Sinai or to the way God created the physical world. And how God created the physical world, to see what God does for us, is also through the Torah. Like, for instance, like I said, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, in his introduction to logic, says that God created the universe, but he gave it over, the responsibility he gave over to the human being to complete it. So therefore you must do two things. You must know that you should appreciate God, and then you must see in the particulars, in your particular life, how it leads back directly to God, that everything leads back directly to God. The trap is that just in general you say, yeah, I recognize everything is from God. But when you live your life and you look at the particulars, you say it's for this reason, for that reason. You look at your parents and yourself and what I did and what my parents did and what the doctor did and what this teacher did. But there you don't recognize in the details how it all goes back through a certain process. The whole thing really goes back to either Mount Sinai or to the way God created the world. The question is that a lot of times people don't see that they're getting things and they don't appreciate what the world has to offer, okay? And, okay, that's one question. That's one question that we'll deal with. And the second question that we'll deal with is, let's say somebody that lived 100 years ago and had one of the diseases and there was no cure for it, it would have been better for him if God created the world complete. But since he had to wait for the human being to discover it, so he didn't make it. So, you know what I mean? Like, it would have been better if God created it complete. All right, so we have these two questions. So Cal wants to say that if God gave us the finished product, then we wouldn't have that much appreciation. There's lots of times where you don't appreciate things, and because you're raised with it, so you take it for granted. So therefore, since you take it for granted, you wouldn't appreciate, so God gives you a chance to appreciate by not having everything and allowing it to come out slowly, so therefore you could start recognizing this new thing and learn to appreciate. Okay, that is one approach. Most of the things in the world that were completed were not done for the benefit of mankind. It was all done for self-aggrandizement. People built, first of all, the first one that we see this happen is the Tower of Babel, that it was done for their aggrandizement, their greatness, you see, and then later, that was in the Torah, but then later in history, we see the pyramids of Egypt and the pyramids here in the South America, that they built unbelievable engineering feats. And they had medicine in early years too, okay, but they all did it because of their own self-aggrandizement. Either they needed it, they had to work for a living, and while they're working for a living, they made a discovery. So they did it for their own personal needs, or for greed. Like today, a lot of things are done for greed, and either for self, well, that's, you know, for the self, it's just for the self, or self-aggrandizement, okay? Now, there are two things wrong. So therefore, when you do self-aggrandizement, there are two things that are wrong. First of all, the thing that you choose to search out and create in the physical world might not be for the needs of the people. Like, for instance, building a pyramid was not exactly a benefit for mankind. It was just a great, it was very nice, you understand? But it wasn't a big need for mankind. It satisfied certain religious needs, but that was just like self-aggrandizement. Okay? The second thing is that since you're doing it for yourself, so therefore your needs become, are awakened because of your lifestyle. In other words, I'll give you an example. I think it's Plato that says, Socrates that says that you could tell a corrupt society when you see two professions that are growing. One is medicine and two is lawyers. Lawyer you need is where two people can't trust each other, and medicine is where you live the correct life. And we add to that in modern times psychology, where you know you don't live in a healthy society, so people have all kinds of conflicts and unhappiness, so they need psychology, you see. So the creativity in these areas, the reason why you have needs is because of your very lifestyle. You would not need, in other words, it might be better to teach the public a better lifestyle so future generations won't need doctors, lawyers, and psychiatrists. I mean, we'll always need them physically, you know, every once in a while something goes wrong. But however, you wouldn't need so many. Most of the people will be happy and have a good life if they were raised in a society of a life of justice and kindness and wisdom. I mean, that would be a good life where, and a person if he's raised in wisdom will think about his health and deal with it and know when to give in to his desires, when not to give in to his desires. The whole society wouldn't be built on a life of pleasure and entertainment, you see. So the thing is that the truth is that God gave us the responsibility to perfect the world, but the human being has not taken on the responsibility correctly, because his emotions are guiding him. His emotions are guiding him away from what is important. And therefore he builds only, like I showed you, for his self-aggrandizement or for greed or for pleasure for one of these things which do not really satisfy. In the long run, it doesn't really satisfy. It gives you immediate pleasure, but it leaves you empty. And therefore, people stop trusting each other after a while, so you need lawyers, and people don't live good lives, so they need doctors. And because they're not, because they're searching for things that they're never really satisfied, so they need psychiatrists because they're never satisfied, you see. When the truth is, and that was Ruth's question about that, people are people think also the question where people don't get what they want is really harmful for themselves. They have to take on the responsibility of taking care of their own life. In Judaism, we hold the human being has responsibility. Now, if things go wrong, you can't always blame it on God. You can't blame it on God. This is God. You didn't take on your responsibility. So therefore, where you feel God is not satisfying you, on the contrary, I say that there's something wrong within your life that you have the responsibility to take care of and straighten out. That's part of your responsibility of maintaining the physical world. So the reason why they don't appreciate God is because they have certain desires that are never satisfied, that you see that people can't be satisfied in all these pleasures. I mean, this we've discussed many times. And so the thing is that they only look at what they're lacking, and they don't analyze to see where they have made the mistake and where they're living life incorrectly, so that they could straighten themselves out and take responsibility for themselves. In other words, when you feel a certain good feeling and you appreciate, you should check back the process. It's either the two areas of process is either it's going to lead back to Torah Mount Sinai, or it's going to lead back to the way God created the physical world, that it can benefit and how it benefits the human being. But many times we don't take the responsibility to do that. That is where the problem lies, not with God. Many times we don't take the responsibility to straighten out our own lives, and then we blame God. You see? That's unappreciative. But appreciative is where you recognize that, look, I have to know where God did and what's my responsibility. And if I take on my responsibility correctly, I'll have a good life. And so therefore, I must recognize where I didn't take on my responsibilities and recognize that's why I'm suffering the consequences. It has nothing to do with God. The question is, there are bad things that happen to people. There are two types of, there's three types of bad people. Three types of bad things that could happen to people. One is where the laws of nature work against you, like, for instance, you buy a volcano. Two is where the society lives a certain type of way of life. Let's say you go to war, and you're in that society. And three, your own decisions. Okay? Now, the thing is that which happens, insofar as bad things happen because of the laws of nature, that is not in your hands unless you have knowledge of the laws of nature, and therefore you could protect yourself against the situation that will occur. But if you do not have the knowledge, so then that is not your fault. Insofar as society is concerned, that is the society made decisions, and they didn't take the responsibility to live a rational life, and they just took the easy way out, where they lived basically according to their emotions. The third is where you make the decisions. And you make the decisions what you're going to do. Either you take responsibility to take care of yourself, or you don't take that responsibility. Okay? Those are the three ways. Insofar as God's justice is concerned in these three areas, that we're not discussing, and these ideas of God's justice has been discussed in many other areas. However, we're just dealing with it only insofar as hakaras hatov, appreciation for God. So therefore, insofar as appreciation to God, when a bad thing happens two times, in other words, when the society and the individual does something wrong, so then you have to take responsibility for yourself. Even if you're raised in a certain society, then you have the responsibility to pull out of living that way and start living differently than the way your society has raised you. So therefore, you have that responsibility. Insofar as the laws of nature is concerned, that is, if you have no knowledge of that it's going to happen, so then you can't take responsibility for that. For those things, you have to rely on God. You have to turn to God, and that's areas of prayer. But these type of questions were answered in many different places insofar as justice is concerned, insofar as when you rely on God is concerned. But however, we're just talking about the appreciation to God for what he has done for us. In other words, where it's for the society, where the society makes a decision, or where the individual makes the incorrect decision, so then he has to take responsibility for himself. But where it's a matter of out of his hands, where something happens where it's totally out of his hands and he can't make a decision in that situation, so there he's not responsible. So therefore, he's not responsible. He can only do the, unless there's something. But however, we're talking about appreciation. Appreciation is always in the past, not in the future. In other words, after you look over the past and you see how it goes all the way back, the process returns to God, so then you could appreciate God. But however, in decision making and in God's justice, that's a different problem. Okay, the question that we're dealing with is, if I have the correct God, do I have to also have the correct value system of life, like justice and kindness, or justice and kindness I could have without the correct God, even if there's not if a person doesn't have the correct God, will he have justice and kindness too? Okay, there are three causes for living a kind or just life. One is my conscience. Alright? Two is that I do not have any conflict, and I'll explain that soon. And three is I'm just because God wants me to be just. Okay, those are the three possibilities, and I'd like to analyze each one. Again, the question was, is there a relationship between God and justice? Okay? If I hold from the true God, does that automatically mean a responsibility for justice and kindness? Okay? That was the original question. Okay? We're discussing three causes for being kind or just. If I keep justice or kindness because of the conscience, so first of all, it means that I'm in conflict. There's a part of me that does not want to be just, and the conscience tells me, makes me feel guilty or shame or fear whenever I want to be unjust or unkind, so it makes me feel these pangs of the conscience, so therefore I keep justice, I'm in conflict. Two, I'll only keep justice, since I only keep it there because of my conflict, I'll only keep justice and kindness only insofar as I get pangs of guilt or shame or fear, only then will I keep it. But if I could bypass it, then I will not keep it. In other words, let's say, for instance, I could steal from an office a stamp. No, I'm not going to get caught. I'm never going to get caught. And, you know what I mean? Nobody's going to know about it. Let's say I could bypass my conscience and I say, they don't care. It's only 37 cents. You see? So you see that a person, when there's that's the type of thing a person could do if he only is just a kind because of a conscience. Is that clear? The second reason why a person is just is because he removed conflict. By nature, a person will be kind and just if he removes conflict. I'll explain why. Because most conflicts is my desires versus your desires. Okay? In other words, like greed, jealousy, all the negative emotions. If I have these negative emotions, so then I could do things that are unjust or unkind. These are the emotions that cause me to be unjust and unkind. So if I remove these emotions, I will automatically, by nature, not want to harm anybody, not want to hurt, and to relate to other people and to want to help them. The question is, is it possible to get rid of like anger or jealousy or vengeance, any of those, or greed, any of those type of negative emotions? Is it possible to get rid of? The answer is yes, and we've discussed it many times. I'm not going to discuss it, you know, now, because that's not our problem, but we've discussed it many times how to deal with these things. If you want to discuss it again, then ask me again, and we'll have that for the next discussion. Okay? Let's say, for instance, I recognize that I have negative emotions, but I'm living on a desert island. Would I have to worry about my negative emotions? The answer is no, because practically I have no outlet. In other words, why should I worry about it? It's not affecting anybody but me, right? So therefore, if I am the second type of person and I have negative emotions, or negative emotions that are left over, I don't care about it. I only need it for practical. It only becomes a practical thing. It's not an essential thing. Okay? It's just a practical. Okay? But let's say if I connect it with God, that means God doesn't want me to have this negative nature, so then even on a desert island, I'd be obligated to perfect my soul by removing the world of the negative emotions, even if it's not practical, because that's part of the perfection of the soul. In other words, once again, on the second level, where the person is doing it only because he removed some of his negative emotions, he's going to worry about negative emotions only if it's practical. There's a practical situation, so then he has to deal with it. But if it's not a practical situation, he doesn't have to deal with it. But if God wants me to live a certain type of life, then he wants me to deal with my negative emotions at all times, because he wants me to perfect the soul, and that is how I relate to God, because I must have removed those negative emotions, because I know it affects my thinking process, and my relationship to God is based totally on my thinking process. So therefore, there is a difference in all three of when you keep justice, in the way you will relate to justice and kindness. Okay? Now, from the Torah we see definitely that it is God's will, that there is definitely a relationship between God and keeping justice. In fact, at one point the prophet says to the people, in a few places, the prophet tells the people that God doesn't want your sacrifices, God wants you to keep justice and kindness. So you see that if you don't keep justice and kindness, then the sacrifices are of no worth. Okay? So therefore, you see that God definitely wants, and throughout Torah, you always find that God wants justice and kindness. The question is, what is the connection between justice and kindness? Insofar, even if it's not a practical thing, what is that in relationship to God? Why must it be an essential relationship to God to have justice and kindness? Since our God is not physical, the true God is not physical, and I cannot know him at all, so the question is, how do I relate to him? I relate to him through his wisdom, through his systems. Okay? So therefore, the only way I could relate to God is through God's systems, by studying God's systems. First system that we study is halacha, and then as we develop, we learn other systems. Okay? But we relate to God through his systems. Okay? The only way we could see God is through God's wisdom. And God's wisdom is in his systems. So when we study, we need the physical as a means to get to the system, but it's his system that we see his wisdom, and then we relate to God through God's wisdom. Okay? So therefore, if there is any component that of the human being that does not relate to the system, to a system, that component is not in line with God. If there's any component of the human being that is not in line with a system, that component is not in line with God. Okay? Now, the only place where my components, where the human components are not in line with a system, is my emotions. It's just a feeling that I feel like hurting this person. I feel like getting money, making money. It's just a feeling. It's not based on any system. In other words, emotions relate to particulars. Emotions relate to particulars, not to ideas. Only the mind relates to ideas. Now, as long as the emotions are attached to the particulars, you see, as long as they are attached to the particulars, then that part of you is not in line with God. But the only way you could get in line with God is through his chachma, through his wisdom. So if there's any component of you that is not in line with that, so then that component means that you're not relating to God. So therefore, even on a desert island, if there's something relating to the particulars, I must deal with that component. Because since I want to relate to God, I want to make every part of my being be in line with God. And the only way I can get that is to stop being attached to the particulars. And what attaches me to the particulars is my emotions, the negative emotions. They attach me to the particulars. You see what I mean? So therefore, as I move away from the particulars and I move to the world of ideas, I get in closer contact to God. So therefore, I must always remove the emotions. So just to summarize, the first level, he's in conflict and he won't do justice wherever he can get away with it, or where his conscience won't bother him, he'll be able to go to do evil. You see? The second level, he doesn't have much of a desire to do evil, but he doesn't have to cure all his emotions if it's not practical, because the only reason why he wants to straighten it out is because of practical reasons. But however, essentially, if you relate to God, you must get rid of it. You must get rid of these emotions that make you think in an incorrect manner, because if you're attached to the particulars, then you're not attached to the universal. And insofar as you're not attached to the universals, then you're not relating to God. And because the universals is the wisdom. That's where you see God's wisdom, and that's how you relate to God, through the wisdom. The question is, what is bad emotions, okay? Bad emotions is when you go where the emotions draw you to an extreme. In other words, let's take greed. There's nothing wrong in making money, but at a certain point you're going too far. So therefore the emotions cause you to go to the extreme. You see, the emotions is what causes you to go to the extreme and not to act rationally. In other words, like anger. I mean, should I be angry? There are times when it's correct to be angry. You understand? It says that, Ohave Hashem Sinura, he who loves God hates evil. You understand? So if your hatred comes via your relationship to God, that type of a hatred is a good type of hatred. But if your hatred comes because it's based on a certain feeling, some ego was touched on, and you get angry, so that's an extreme. So all emotions, in other words, what we're against is where the way you could tell where the emotions is an extreme is where the emotions make decisions for you, and even though there are consequences, you can't control them. You see what I mean? That's how you can tell when it's an extreme. So the thing is that we're not against emotions. We're against where the emotions make decisions. Now, if you're totally guided by wisdom, so then wisdom makes decisions, and then you relate to God. But insofar as you're attached to the particular, that takes us away from our understanding of God, that he's totally not physical. In other words, in other religions where they have something physical, they relate to their God through the particular. They have the statue of Jesus, so they relate to God, to their God, through that particular. You see? So they need the particulars. We, in our religion, we're trying to get the God that we can't relate them to particulars, so only by removing the particulars and relating to the universals and to the wisdom of God can we relate to God.
All right, we're doing Mishlei, chapter 11, verse 23. And it says that the desire of the righteous is only for good, and the hopes of the wicked is anger. And the question is that people might desire for somebody else good, but however, they're in conflict about doing it. Sometimes they could do good, but they're in conflict. Here it says his desire is for good. Most people that desire to do good are in conflict. They desire to do good, but in the moment of anger, they desire to do something other than good. So the thing is that the question is, what does it mean only for good? The Ibn Ezra says that if you remove your negative traits, naturally you will do good. All you have to do is remove the negative traits, or the extremes of any traits, and then naturally you will do good. That is what the Ibn Ezra says. Now the question is, in the second half of the verse, why does it say that the hopes of the wicked is anger? Why is it used anger? It's used many other, evil. You know what I mean? It would be better. Why anger? The question is, what is the cause of anger? What causes a person to be angry? The cause of anger is where your ego has been touched. In other words, whenever you're insulted, somebody does something that you don't want to do, that you don't want them, even when somebody does something that you don't want them to do. So a person can get angry because his ego is such that he wants everybody to listen to him. So the thing goes, the ego, depending the way your ego goes, you get angry when your ego is hit. And so therefore, that's what the second half of the verse is talking about. Okay? So the question is, what is the subject of the pasuk? What is the subject? And now that we understand both sides separately, the question is, what is the subject? Okay, the subject is humility. In other words, if you remove all extreme emotions or all negative emotions, then that is humility. But when you're an angry person, when you see that you constantly get angry, whether you carry it out or not is something else. Some people control their anger, some people hide their anger. But whatever it is, once you get angry, it shows that you have the opposite of humility, which is involved with the self, or the importance of the self. Insofar as you would see a humble person that he's angry, so insofar as that is concerned, then he hasn't removed his ego completely. He still has a certain amount of ego left. In other words, the person, to be perfectly humble, I mean, you're talking about a very unique person, but however, he still has an emotion left. That emotion could be hit, yes. Okay? Okay, we're going to do verse 24, 25, and 26. And it says like this. There are those who scatters and gathers more, and one who refrains from what is proper only for a loss. That's verse 24. 25. The soul that blesses will grow fat. By fat means successful. And one who sates others will himself be sated. 26. What? By sated we mean satisfied. Okay, 26. One who withholds produce from others will be cursed by the nation. But blessing will be on the head of the provider. Okay, the first verse says, once again, the first verse. Okay, let's do one verse at a time. There is one who scatters and gathers more, and one who refrains from what is proper only for a loss. First question is, what does he scatter? We have to understand what does he scatters. And most of the commentaries say that he scatters money. In other words, he gives money for righteous things. And the reason how they get for righteous things, because the second half of the verse says, the one who refrains from what is proper is only for a loss. Okay? So the question is like this. If I give away money, that is really a loss. And he's saying that if I give away money for tzedakah, I will get more back. Okay? In fact, the Meiri says that he'll gather more, meaning that he'll get more than he gave. And the one who refrains from what is proper only for a loss, it's not true. If I don't give you tzedakah, so then I have more money for myself. The verse is going opposite common sense. And the question is, why? What does the pasuk say? Okay, the answer is you have to first understand by tzedakah, there's two areas of tzedakah. There's halachic tzedakah that a lot of people give. There's tzedakah that represents a certain personality. Personality that we just spoke about in verse 23 is the person that removed his negative emotions. Means that his desire for money is only for practical things. It's only practical. It's not like greed or stingy. He doesn't want to hold on to money. So the thing is that over here, if a person has that type of a personality, that he knows his needs and he knows that he could give to others and he doesn't have to hold on to every penny but to give to others, so that personality will not make mistakes in his decision. Will not make mistakes because he doesn't have the emotions to make mistakes. What causes a person to fail is that he makes decisions based on certain emotions. So when he removes the emotions, when money becomes a practical thing, not beyond reality where you got to spend your whole life making money or your whole life not spending money,
So that person will be more successful in the end because he won't make mistakes, but the rich people will. I mean, people that really, not all rich, word rich is wrong. I would say the people that are greedy or stingy. Those emotions, at some point, will harm them. Okay, the next verse, verse 25, says that so that blesses will grow fat, and one who satisfies from tzedakah to kindness, all types of kindness, wherever you could help, wherever you have your blessings, so then you could help others. Okay, so it comes out, it's the same idea. Okay? Except it's extending it to other things, to kindness in general, and not to charity. Okay. Now, one who withholds produce will be cursed by the nation, but blessing will be on the head of the provider. Okay? When the nation is in need, okay, like let's say in a famine, so then the person that is stingy and holds back, or when there's the bad times, they charge more because they know they could get more because there's not that much, there's not so much, so people could get it. That person is hated by the people. Defined by Enron, I mean, these people were hated. I mean, these very wealthy people, and everybody wants to bring them down because they're hated by everybody because of they destroyed the people in their own company. They didn't care about anybody but themselves, and they didn't care for the fact that they affect the nation that way, and so therefore they're very much hated, and people are trying to bring them down. Okay? So the last one is that when it extends, when you become greedy to such an extent where you're very powerful and you go against the nation when the nation needs it, you will be hated by the nation, and that in itself will bring its own consequences, like we explained. The question is that how does laziness affect the home? Okay, that's the question that we're discussing. Okay, and the answer is that a family, really each person in the family has a certain responsibility, and insofar as you don't take care of that responsibility, so then it would affect the way the rest of the family operates. It would give the burden of that responsibility to other people in the family, or if nobody took it on, that it will not get done, which it has to get done. Also, if parents are lazy, so that would affect the children. Many times children learn from what parents do, not what they say. And therefore, they will pick up on their laziness and they'll learn from them, so it'll be harming the children. And also, if they're lazy in their responsibility, children could feel neglected. So therefore, that would also be a harm to the child. The question is, what if somebody's physically hurt and they can't take care of their responsibility? What is the difference between that and laziness, okay? The answer is, it is true practically, the rest of the family is going to have to chip in to work together to make up for where that person can't take care of their responsibility. That happens to be true. But there is a difference in the reason. In other words, where somebody can't help themselves, so then it's understandable there's a certain idea of justice that you have to be responsible for a person that can't do it. Where a person is lazy, where they refuse to take responsibility, so then it's his own fault. I mean, why should you? Then there's no justice in helping the person. It's he should take on his responsibilities. So there's a difference in the situation. It's true, practically, there is no difference. That if a person is hurt and he can't physically and he can't help, and a lazy person, but in one case, You have responsibility to help him out because he can't help himself, and that is what justice is where you work where others can't. That's the idea of charity, where a person cannot make a living, and you have to help him. But by laziness, he refuses to take on responsibility, So then you don't have the responsibility to help him out. It is true that if there's somebody's lazy in the family, so other people, because they love him, they might make up for him. I'm talking about there's no responsibility on your part based on justice and ideas that it's that then he is being unfair. You see what I mean? So therefore, you shouldn't, but insofar as you want to work it out for them and you want to help them, I mean, then fine, that's okay. I have a riddle, okay? The riddle goes like this. There are people that don't have free will before an act, but they have free will after the act. And there's certain people that have free will before the act, but they don't have free will after the act. But let's clarify the word act. The word act means that I'm doing an action, like I do something. I do an act. I have to do an act and have to make a decision what to do. That would be free will. You understand? So I do an act. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to go for a drive. I'm going to talk to somebody. You understand? It's a act. Okay? An ordinary, everyday act. I think that every person has one of these two types. What they have is that they don't have, either they don't have free will before the act, or they have free will after the act. And there's certain people that have free will before the act, but they don't have free will after the act. And I'm not talking about the act. You're working on the act is everyday life acts. I react. I buy something compulsively. I get angry. I mean, any type of thing that a person does, every type of act, when a person is that the act, I'm not making any distinctions in, just the free will. First of all, I'd like to say that there are two types of free will. There's philosophical free will and practical free will. Philosophical free will is where there is no cause. Free will means that there is no past cause. I'm not talking about that. That's a very difficult concept. And I'm not discussing philosophical free will. Yeah, I'm only talking about practically making decisions, okay? I'm using free will only in the practical sense, okay? There's certain people that do a compulsive act, and they just can't think of, without thinking they do that act, right? After the act, when the emotion is gone, then they have a lot of possibilities. They realize, in other words, they usually say, I should have, I could have, and I would have. Okay? If only. You know what I mean? And it's only after the act that they start realizing all the possibilities. Okay? And, okay, so that's the first way. I'd just like to add the way to cure the first way, if you're interested in curing it, is after you've gone through all the could've, should've, and would've's, okay, all the possibilities, then to stop and think, what emotion blanked out all these possibilities, and why were these possibilities blanked out? So you have to think about what the emotion is that doesn't allow you to think straight. And after many times of after the act that you start thinking that way, then it could help you to straighten out that type of behavior. Okay? The second kind is free will before the act, where a person thinks logically of all the possibilities. Now, if he comes to an incorrect conclusion and he makes a mistake, then again he has to look at what emotion made him make the mistake. Okay, because then you have to say if he made a mistake, it's because his free will was taken away, his emotion was taken away, the reason why he should have chosen the other way.
So therefore, again, he has to, again, analyze the emotion. But if he chose the correct possibility, then he has to look back at all the causes of how he came to that conclusion. In other words, if he has a certain personality, he thinks a certain way, he had a certain teacher that opened his mind to thinking in a certain way. So therefore, the thing is that he can't take credit for choosing the correct one, because he realizes that all along he was taking steps that based on his personality. In other words, let's say, for instance, a teacher teaches you an idea, right, in a class. Now, certain students take to the idea, certain students don't. Now, why do certain students take to the idea and certain students don't? The answer is that certain don't, they have certain emotions against. Certain students, if they're not thinkers, so they choose based on their emotions, it sounds good. Or if they are a thinker, so then their personality was that they're a thinker, so they're able to think that way. So it's all because of the causes that came about, you see? So therefore, they should really see that they are not the cause, so that that would take away the emotion of that I take credit for everything I do. But you really can't, because most of it is based on either your personality or some teacher or some book you read, you know what I mean, that something opened your mind to something, and that's how you can reach this point, you see? So practically speaking, those are the... everybody is one of those two people. The question is that are there cases where spontaneous acts are the correct act, okay? And the thing is that there's two types of spontaneous correct acts. One is a person without training just reacts spontaneously. In some cases, it's a matter of luck that, like, for instance, somebody, a sudden time, you have to make an immediate decision. Somebody's in trouble, and you can't wait 2 minutes. You have to make a sudden decision, okay? Now, the thing is, it depends on your personality. If your personality is to act correctly, so then sometimes, you know what I mean, then sometimes it'll work out. Then sometimes, if you're without training, you could do a catastrophic thing, and that spontaneous thing. The way that it can work out is through always guiding through chachma what the correct act is. Then you train your emotions to react based on all the training you had. So then based on all the training that you have, the spontaneous act will a higher probability of being correct. Because there's always the emotion that could affect you, that spontaneous situation in an adverse way. But that spontaneous decision should only be made only in a situation where you have no choice. You don't have the time to think it through. You must act immediately. But otherwise, then you have no choice. You have to act spontaneously. And the results will be whether emotionally or naturally you naturally know what to do in this situation, or you've been trained to make correct decisions, and therefore spontaneously you make the correct decision. The question is what about a clarification of what we mean by after the fact, I do not have a free will, okay? A philosophical free will means that there is no cause. Okay? In other words, there's no prior cause. I am the cause. I choose between being good or bad. Good or evil. That's the big problem. We don't see anything without a cause, a prior cause. It has to do with my personality, there's always causes that bring about a certain thing. That's why people cannot accept free will. That's the problem with free will. Now, I might not be able to explain philosophical free will, but I accept it because I accept Torah. God gave his commandments, which means that I have a choice whether I could do it or not. You understand? But I can't explain it. Some people might be able to explain how it works. I can't explain philosophical free will because we're saying there's something within you that in and of itself chooses between good and evil without a cause. without a prior cause. That is the cause. That is the beginning cause where it makes that decision. See, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about practically how people make decisions based on everyday life, not dealing with philosophical free will. And since I'm dealing with the practical, then everything in my history brought about why I'm acting this way today. In other words, I had a certain personality, I met a certain person that opened my mind, so I was able to think about what he was saying. If I didn't have that personality, even if he said it, so then it wouldn't turn off. They wouldn't accept it. You understand? There's always a difference. You understand? So practical free will, I'm saying, practical free will is the way you make decisions in everyday life. Philosophical free will doesn't happen in everyday life. Okay? Philosophical free will change the direction. Some situation or something will change the direction in which you're going. You can't change the direction. But however, practical free will is based on, you know, decisions in everyday life. Decisions in everyday life will always be, you could look back on all the causes of what brought about you to be at this stage, how you made this correct decision. In other words, let's say, for instance, I was trained, I had a teacher and trained me to analyze things before I do things. And I am a good student and I learned it. So now, before an act, I'm able to look at all the possibilities rationally and make a decision. Okay? Now I make the correct decision. Now, what brought about this correct decision? Was it me? Or was it a teacher teaching me, and I happened to have had that type of personality that could accept from the teacher? You see? So therefore, it really wasn't free will that I did it. It's true, I thought through all the logical possibilities, but it wasn't based on me that I am the philosophical cause of my action. I look back at all the causes as if I didn't have free will, and it just came about based on my personality and my situation. That's practical free will. Ultimate free will, you can change your life around. There are free will situations where you're making a decision where it'll totally change your life. And that you are the cause. You are making that decision. How you do it, how it works, I don't know. You know, you have to explain how something works without no prior cause. That is the cause itself. How do you explain that? I don't know how to explain it. Hey, the question is, if somebody chooses that he lives the life of free will, is it possible that there is times where he won't live the life of free will? Yeah, the answer is that certain situation brings out a powerful emotion which took away his free will. You see that in Torah, Moshe, when it came to the hitting of the rock, he was supposed to speak to the rock and he hit the rock. You know what I mean? He reacted at that moment and he had to deal with the emotion, whatever that emotion was. You understand? So yeah, you could change, an emotion could affect your decision-making process. We're doing Proverbs chapter 11, verse 30. And it says, "The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. And he who acquires souls is wise." The first question is what is he contrasting? You usually have two things that contrast. What is he contrasting here? The next question is what are the fruits of the righteous? The Ibn Ezra says that the fruits of the righteous is his thoughts, the thoughts of his mind. That's the thoughts of his mind. And he teaches Musa from his mouth. That is the tree of life, when he teaches Musa.
The next question is, what is acquiring souls? The next question is, why is one half deal with the righteous and the second half deal with the wise? I mean, it should be either both right. It should be, you know, I mean, he's making a change. He's making two changes. One, he's talking about the fruits of the righteous, right? And he teaches wisdom. And then the wisdom, then by wise, he acquires souls. We don't know what acquiring souls are yet. Rashi and the Ibn Ezra says that lokeach nefashos means acquiring souls, means that that he educates them, that he teaches them, right? So the thing is, if that is true, then what is the difference between the first half and the second half, and why is the first half talking about a tzaddik and the second half talking about a chacham? The thing is that the difference between a chacham and a tzaddik is a chacham is a person that, a wise person is a person that has incorrect emotions, but he wants to avoid the consequences of the incorrect emotions, so he tries to make decisions based on wisdom. So he always evaluates, he has to evaluate the consequences of his acts. Okay? That's a chacham. A tzaddik, on the other hand, his nature is to live a just life. He recognizes that he's part of the system, and he must live part of the system, and it's more natural that he should live a life of justice and righteousness. Okay? That's why it says that when he speaks, the righteous speak. In other words, it doesn't say what he speaks. Well, according to the Ibn Ezra, he's speaking Musa. He naturally teaches others to make decisions because he's a just person, and when he speaks, he naturally speaks in a rational way. You see? The Chacham, on the other hand, has to have a reason. He understands, he has to see the consequences and the results of his actions. He wouldn't do it just for justice. He would do it because it's a benefit or a harm. He will do it if it's a benefit, and will avoid doing it if it's a harm, because he thinks in terms of consequences, while the tzaddik does things naturally. Just a side point, I'd just like to say, sometimes the tzaddik, if there's an emotion that hits him, he has to revert back to the chacham level, where he has to start looking for consequences. You see what I mean? He can revert back in certain situations where there's a powerful emotion, and the philosophical world will not affect him there because of his emotion, powerful emotions. You see? So therefore, that's the difference between the chacham and the tzaddik. That would be good, except for one thing. Why does it say he acquires souls? In other words, it has nothing to do with acquiring souls. In other words, if the Chacham would teach, see, the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik, the Chacham would teach because he sees the benefit of teaching. Because he wants to learn, and he sees through teaching he can gain more by teaching it to others and expressing it to others. So it should say that there's some type of benefit for him. You see, in terms of the Chacham, you have to show how it's a benefit for the Chacham, because he still has his old emotions. He can only do things for selfish reasons. But however, the tzaddik is guided by the truth, by reality, by the love of truth, so therefore he's guided by the philosophical. If the reality dictates that he should teach others, so therefore he'll do it. You see? So that would make a good distinction. That would make a very good distinction between the tzaddik and the chacham, why the tzaddik teaches, why the chacham teaches. The chacham teaches because it's a benefit to himself. The tzaddik teaches, of course, to benefit to others, and he must do justice. Okay? Okay? But however, the question is, why did they express it? The word he acquires souls doesn't seem to express the idea. I mean, what does the acquiring of souls mean? You know what I mean? Acquiring of souls means that you change their personality, change the way they operate. That's how you acquire them. You see, you acquire them because when you educate them,
So they change the way they think and the way they operate, the way they make decisions. So therefore, you have changed them. You see, that's what I think it means acquire. Because now they're in line with what you're saying. But that is not the motive of the Chacham. The motive of the Chacham is not so much for the other person as for himself. Ashi is correct. It would be more proper to say the opposite. It would be that the Chacham is doing it for the Tree of Life, for himself, while the other one, the Tzaddik, is doing it to acquire souls. Okay? So that is the question what we have. What is the verse talking about? The question is that maybe the motive for the Chacham is to win over souls. Okay? Now, there are certain people that want to win over other people. Okay? Now, the thing is that when you want to win other people over, the Chacham is a person that recognizes that the basic drive of the human being is selfish. You see? And that when you are kind to others, you have to understand why you should be kind. Sometimes kind could be a harm. Even that has to be thought out. You see? So therefore, the thing is the Chacham is going to ask the question, if it's a matter of justice, so then they have to teach him for justice. Okay? Because the Torah says so. If it's a matter of my benefit, so then it's selfish. What is the benefit for me to acquire these people? What is the benefit to me? See, the Chacham always asks the question, what is the benefit to me? You understand? Unless it's just a matter of Torah. But that's an ego thing to want to acquire people, that I want to reach out to people. That's like an ego, like I have people following me, you know what I mean? That would not be the decision of the Chacham, or definitely not the Tzaddik. Chacham means he's guided by his decisions, by wisdom, that he understands the mind, sees clearly why he should teach. What's the benefit? Well, if there's a matter of Torah, well, I have an obligation to Torah. Fine. But Mishlei deals with personality, and the basic personality is selfish. Acquiring, I look at acquiring here not as a desire, but it's defining the reality that you have changed this person's nature and changed him to a different type of lifestyle through your education. So it's not a motivation, it's defining a certain act. But why should it use that framework to tell me the difference between the motivation of the Chacham and the Tzaddik? I mean, I think they could do it in a better... I think King Solomon could do it in a better way. In other words, the definition of a Chacham is a person that can make decisions, correct decisions, rational decisions, despite his emotions. Okay? Against those emotions that are against wisdom, and yet he'll, because of the consequences, either the consequences are beneficial so he'll do the act, or the consequences are harmful so he won't do the act, but it will be against his emotions. The philosophical person, the tzaddik, that's guided by wisdom itself, you see, that type of person is guided by the truth. It has nothing to do with consequences. He's drawn to reality itself. You see? That's what I understand. There's the difference between the Chacham and the Tzaddik, but this pasuk seems to be pointing at a different quality, which I don't know what it is at this point. Okay, the answer is that the answer seems to be like this, that the nature of the Tzaddik is that, like Rashi says, his actions help people, and the Ibn Ezra says his teachings help people. So, but he does it naturally. It's a natural thing. It's like a second nature because he became a thinker. The Chacham is not a natural thing.
he has to work it through despite his emotions not to do it, you see? So therefore, what he has to do, in other words, it's an act, it's a forced act of acquiring people. In other words, teaching. In other words, when I teach as a chacham, it's true that it's for my own gain, but the only way I'm going to gain is through answering all the questions and dealing with all the questions. So I have to go about it as if my act was to acquire them, as if my purpose was to change them over. In other words, I do have the desire to change them over. The Chacham is interested in justice, but Mishlei is not talking about a person. A Chacham doesn't do justice. He does justice. But even when he does justice, he always sees what's the benefit of the justice. Why is there a benefit? And he has to see a benefit. And it's not a natural thing. So the act has to be as if he wants to acquire the souls. The tzaddik does it because, in other words, there's two ways of reaching people. One is your very existence reach people. The way you live, the way you talk, the way you act. You see? So therefore, when you do that, your natural life, that's the tzaddik. The chacham is not like that. Everything has to be worked out. What are the consequences? What are the benefits? What are the harms? You see, he has to constantly work it out. So since he has to constantly work it out, he has to say, what is the best way of reaching the student? Because the best way of reaching the student would be the best way of gaining. You understand? Because that's going to be the best for me if I do it. In other words, if I do it in a way that's not best for the student, so then it's not going to be good for me either. Why? Because then I might not teach it. That'll be a fool. A fool will teach it just to give over the information. He's not sure if it's clear. He just wants to talk, you see? But when you're relating to the student and you have to listen to what the student is saying to make sure that you're answering the student and that you're dealing with the student, and that's how you're able to develop your own type of thinking and your own type of development, you see? So then that is as if your motive is to win them over. You don't have a desire to win them over, but it must be at that way. When you teach that way, that is the way of the Chacham, and that is the way of the most benefit. It could be that that's what the Pasuk is talking about. In other words, the greatest gain to the person that is teaching, if he teaches in such a way as to benefit the student, that would be the greatest gain for the teacher. And since the teacher is interested in the greatest gain, so therefore he must do it as if he's trying to win the student over. But the tzaddik, on the other hand, the pasuk is saying his very nature will win people over. The way he operates, the very way he does things, he wins people over. And we're doing chapter 11, verse 31. It says, it's true that the righteous, if the righteous in the land are paid, then certainly the wicked and the sinner. Rashi says, what does it mean they're paid? What does it mean paid? Paid means that he gets punished for his sins. When people see most of the times when we see something bad happens to a righteous person, we have the question, where is God's justice? Okay? That's the big question, where's God's justice? This verse is looking at it when a righteous person is punished for his he gets the consequences for his wrongdoings. So he's looking at it from another angle. If a righteous person can be punished, certainly the wicked. In other words, King Solomon is saying that lots of times you see a righteous person and he's punished and there's a certain feeling that why is it worth it to be righteous? I might as well be wicked. You understand? There's no value in being righteous
because you see, he gets consequences no different than me. You see? So the answer is that you feel that there's no value in it, and therefore you can get away with it. But King Solomon is telling you to look at it the opposite, from the opposite point of view, and that is, if the righteous can be punished, then certainly if you're wicked, you definitely will be punished. You see? The question is that the reason why the righteous get paid, because as they get caught, because they don't know how to be wicked. But if you really know how to be wicked, then you won't get caught. Okay? So therefore, you look righteous. Not that you are righteous. You look righteous. Because you didn't get caught. Okay? But the only thing is that it's a wrong understanding of what we mean righteous. Righteous means that he's trained in thought and he thinks everything through. And if he did cheat, he would work it out with chachma or wisdom. He would work it out that he should not get caught. In other words, like this. So the question is that how come he's getting paid here? He's getting consequences. So he did something wrong. Yeah, he did something wrong because everybody has emotions. And the emotions affect us in the wrong way. Even Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake. God told him to speak to the rock, and he hit the rock. Then emotion took over, and that emotion caused him to react and not to think through things thoroughly. So therefore, because he reacted, he paid the consequences. Everybody has that emotions. You see? So therefore, and when I say consequences, it could be consequences in the laws of nature, or consequences in God punishing you. You see? But either way, the view from here is that it's that when you see the tzaddik being punished, there's a certain emotion that King Solomon is saying is a mistake. And that emotion is, look, if he gets caught, I might as well be wicked. But the more wicked you are, the worse the punishment, the worse the consequences, whether in this world or the next world. You see? So therefore, that's what the verse is saying, is to look at the consequences of the righteous from a different angle than the way we usually look at it. And the question is that we're dealing with is, what is the prerequisite of a thinker? To be a thinker, what are the prerequisites? What they want to say, the first prerequisite is that you, in with a person, someplace in your society or in with a person that has opened your mind to the idea of questioning altogether. So somebody asked a question by Abraham. Abraham didn't have anybody that was a thinker. The answer to that is, I'm not familiar with the society that he came from. But however, it is possible that their basic premises was idolatry and superstition. But however, they could have been well versed in technology, and their technology was used for working out different areas of their idolatry. You see, so it is possible that there was a certain amount of wisdom. And Abraham, what he did different that was unique was Abraham questioned the basic premises of his society that nobody ever did before that. It could be that's what happened with Abraham. In other words, you can't say a prerequisite of thinking is going beneath the surface, because that is a thinker. A thinker is a person that goes beneath the surface. Okay, one of the prerequisites is a training how to think. Training, and sometimes, you know, through a teacher or through your own studies, there must be a certain training of the mind to think correctly, you see. But being a thinker means going beneath the surface because of certain, you think beneath the surface. Superficial person just looks at things, and their emotions make them make the decision just the way they feel, and they don't look beneath the surface. Another one of the prerequisites is that you need a motivation. You need a motivation for thought. In other words, if you don't have any motivation, then you're not going to have a thought. Okay, there is a pasuk in Chumash by Paro where the Jews are multiplying. It says, and Paro says, "Hava nischach malo." Let us wisen to them. Okay? Now, the word nischachma is hispa'el. Hispa'el means where I force myself. It's a grammatical form of the verb that means that I must force myself to do it. In other words, by nature, Paro was not a thinker, but however, in this case, because of this specific problem, he says, let us force ourselves to think about the problem. It wasn't the natural thing, but he had a motivation. But a real thinker doesn't need outside motivation. He needs an inner motivation to drive him to go beneath, that naturally he desires to know what's going on beneath the surface. You have no interest to go beneath the surface, then you just... it's just going to be like water off a duck. It's just not going to affect you, even if you hear ideas. It's just not going to do anything for you. Another prerequisite that's mentioned in Mishle, in chapter 12, verse 1, is that a person must have Musa, involved in the world of Musa, the world of making decisions in everyday life. Says, because if he's not involved, now he doesn't explain it, he just says that is the prerequisite. You can't have wisdom without Musa. The answer is that even if you are a thinker, these emotions, the reason is that even if you're a thinker, then it will come out that your emotions can affect the way you make decisions. In other words, and therefore you will not come to correct conclusions. In other words, see, there's two types of emotions. There's one emotion where I'm not a thinker at all. In other words, there's one type of person that's emotional that does not think at all. He just makes decisions based on his feeling of the moment. There's certain people that think things through, but if they have strong emotions, it would affect their decision-making. Okay, they'll affect the decision and the outcome of the decision, so that the decision won't be based on the facts, the analysis of the facts, but on results that the emotions desire. So therefore, another prerequisite of the world of ideas and study must be to recognize when your emotions are affecting your thoughts.